गौरांगी राधे वृंदावनेश्वरी वृषभानुसुते देवी प्रणमामि हरि प्रिये वंशाकल्पतरुभ्यश्च कृपासिन्धुभ्यैव च पतितानां पावनेभ्यो वैष्णवेभ्यो नमो नमः श्रीकृष्ण चैतन्य प्रभु नित्यानंद श्री अद्वैत गदाधर शिवासादि गौर भक्तवृंद हरे कृष्ण 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 हरे 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 राम 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 हरे हरे
Few more commentaries which I should use with for the previous section that we saw from text 17 to text 20. I'll first read out some points from Madhvacharya. अंतवंत इमे देहा That was text 18 and Acharya Madhva brings up I'll only point out a few points I will not go into detail he points out that you see the words इमे देहा अंतवंत इमे देहा नित्यस्योक्ता शरीरिणः The body is of the embodied soul. Of the embodied soul. Charirnaha. Talking of the bodies of the embodied soul as being as having an end, they're perishable. And he adds this remark in his first commentary. Charirna iti Ishvara Vyavrtaye. That Krishna is specifically mentioning that these bodies of the embodied soul, because he wants to make it clear that the bodies of the Supreme Lord are not perishable. The Supreme Lord also has bodies. He has spiritual bodies. He has unlimited expansions and he has spiritual bodies. They are not perishable. If Krishna did not say Sharirinaha, then it would not be clear, because Krishna himself is talking to him, to Arjuna. Krishna has a body. So when Krishna says Ime Deha, these bodies would include his own body. So in order to make it understood that these bodies of the embodied soul, not these bodies of me. So in order to make that very distinct, he uses this word, Sharirinaha. Madhvacharya also explains that the living entity is like a reflection of the Lord, but like an eternal reflection of the Lord. It's an eternal reflection of the Lord. That is his explanation of the relationship between the living entities and the Supreme Lord. It's called Bimba Pratibimba Sambandha. Bimba Pratibimba Bhava. In text 17, in his second commentary, he points out that there are different types of destructions. See, avinashi tu tadvidhi yena sarvamidam tatam. This talks about Vishnu, according to his second commentary, that the super soul is indestructible. Now there are four types of destructions. Anityatvam dehahaner dukkha praptir apurnata nashas chaturvidah proptas tad bhavo hareh sada tad anyesham tu sarvesham nashah kechit bhavantihi iti mahavarahe. The Mahavaraha Purana states that there are four defects One is not being eternal. The other is having a body which gets destroyed. The other is attainment of distress. And the last one is being constitutionally incomplete, imperfect. This is what is meant by nasha or destruction. And in Lord Hari, these four defects don't exist at all. So he is indestructible in the highest sense. Amongst other living entities, they have different levels of destructibility. They have different, they have one or more of these. And then he quotes from Paramashruti, Deshatah Kalatashchaiva Gunatashcha Tridhatatihi Sa Samastha Harereva Nahyan Ye Purna Sadguna. That the Lord is unlimited, or he is all pervading in space, in time, and also in terms of his qualities. He has unlimited qualities. So these features are there only in Lord Hari. They are not there in others. In text 18, in his commentary to text 18, he writes, Sharirinam tu deha hanyadi nasho vidyate eva, that amongst the embodied souls, destructibility of these four types, they do exist. And also they are not perfect. They are not complete in the sense that they can they pervade over space, or they don't have all qualities. Anichaya deha hanyade reva dukha vapti siddha. And even against their desire, their bodies are destroyed, so they have to attain distress. So ultimately speaking, in text 18, this anashino aprameyasya tasmadyutyasya bharata, the real person who is indestructible, the immeasurable person who is indestructible, ultimately refers to Lord Vishnu. Ultimately. Then, on top of it, just see the type of analysis they do, very, very, very detailed. In text 18, Krishna had said, Ime Deha, these bodies of the embodied soul are perishable. Why does he say these bodies? Why couldn't he could have said the bodies? And he points out, Ime Deha iti visheshanat nityaha chiddanandatmakaha swarupa bhutaha dehaha muktanam api vidyate iti gyayate. This is from this expression, ime deha, these bodies, we understand that from this adjective we understand that the liberated souls also have a body which is their own nature, and which is eternal, and which is spiritual and blissful. So those bodies are not perishable. Only these bodies are perishable. And then he quotes from Bhagavatam itself, second canto. Na vartate yatra rajastamastayo sattvam cha mishram nachakala vikrama nayatra maya kimata pare hare ranuvrata yatra sura surarchita shyamavadata shatapatra lochana vishanga vastra surucha supeshasa sarve chaturba hava unmishan mani pravekan nishka bharana suvarchasa pravala vai duryam pranala varchasam parispurat kundala mauli malinam rajishnu bhirya parito virajate lasad vimana valibhir mahatmanam vidyotaman na pramadottama bhi sav vidyodabhra valibhir yathanabha iti hi bhagavate. The Bhagavatam describes in the second canto that when Lord Brahma, when he saw the liberated souls, he saw that they had bodies of different, they had four arms, they were having jewels, they were glorifying the Supreme Lord in the presence of their wives. They are not affected by rajas, tamas, or the mode of goodness which is mixed. There is no influence of time there. There was no influence of maya. They are all servants of Lord Hari. They are worshipped by the suras and the asuras, and so on. So we understand that the liberated souls actually have bodies. Chidananda sharirena sarve mukta yatha hari bhunjate kamato bhokams tadantar bahire vacha iti paramashrutihi. The paramashruti notes that the liberated souls, they also have spiritual, blissful bodies, and they experience various delights internally and externally, just as Lord Hari. So Ime Deha refers to these bodies. These bodies are referring to material bodies. Na cha jiva ishvara aikyam muktavapi. He also points out, you cannot say that the jiva and the ishvara are actually one at the status of liberation. And then he gives a lot of evidence. He gives a lot of evidence to point out that even at the status of liberation, final liberation, there is a difference between the Lord and the living entities. And then he quotes from various texts which are very commonly quoted by the Advaitavadis to point out that actually we are one with God. Several statements he quotes, including Tattvamasi, Aham Brahmasmi, so many. And then he quotes from other scriptures which naturally offer a straightforward explanation, which are not Advaitic. Long, in this edition it comes to what, 1, 2, 3, 4, almost 4 pages of simply quotations, 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 to explain each and every statement quoted by the Advaitavadis. They are famous. They have a certain set of pet quotations. So he gives counter quotes to explain each and every one of them. There are two details I'm not able to get into it. Okay. So that was Sri Madhva. I will see if Ramanuja had made any remarks, and then afterwards I'll see if Keshav Kashmiri makes any remarks, and then we'll get back to this section. Avinashi tu tadvidhi, 17. Yena sarvamidam tatam. Vinasham avyasyasya nakashchit kartum arhati. Atmanastu avinashitvam katham upapadyate iti atraha. How can you say that the living entity is indestructible? Anticipating this question, he says, tat atmatattvam avinashi iti vidhi. You should know that that principle of the atma is indestructible. Yena atmatattvena chetanena tad vyatiriktam idam achetanam sarvam tatam vyaptam. Matter is pervaded by spirit. Vyapakatvena niratishaya sukshmatva atmanaha vinasha anarhasya tad vyatirikto nakashchit padartho vinasham kartum arhati tad vyapyataya tasma sthulatva. You see, that which pervades, you have the that which pervades, the vyapaka, and that which is pervaded, which is vyapya. So that which is the pervader is more subtle than that which is pervaded. So that which is gross cannot destroy that which is subtle. Nashakam hi shastram jalagni vayu adikam nashyam vyapya shithili karoti. If you, the destroyer, such as a weapon, which could be of different types. You have mystical weapons, mystical water weapons, mystical fire weapons, mystical tornado weapons, etc. they take the object that is meant to be, that is meant to be destroyed, and they pervade over it and then they break it. But then, how can you do it to something which is more subtle than it? So it is not possible. In text 18, Antavante Ime Deha, he says, Dehanam tu vinashitvam eva swabhavah. It is the very nature of the bodies that they are destructible. Because they are collections. They are upachayas, they are aggregates. They are aggregates. Diha upachaya iti upachaya rupa ime deha antavantaha virasha swabhava upachayatmaka hi ghatadayaha antavantaha drishtaha. Consider an aggregate like a pot. A pot is made up of other substances put together. Therefore it is destructible. Similarly, the body is an aggregate. It is different things are put together and that is the body. Therefore the body is destructible. Nityasya sharirinaha karmaphala bhogarthataya bhuta sanghata rupa deha punya punyeta ityadi shastrai huktaha karma avasana vinashinaha. That they are destroyed, the bodies are destroyed corresponding to their karma. And they are sanghata rupa, bhuta sanghata rupa. They are elements put together. And they are meant to be used for enjoying one's, experiencing one's karma phala, the fruit of one's karma. Atma tu avinashi, kutaha apremehetva. But the Atma is indestructible because it cannot be measured. He gives further points, but they are detailed. See if Keshav Kashmiri brings any additional points. Okay, I'll read his comment on Antavanta Imedeha, which is text 18. Nan Vatmanam Vinasha Anarhatvena Nityatva Muktam Tarhi Sarvesha Matri Pitradayo Nashta Itya Bharita Pratite Ke Vishaya Itya Ashankyaha Antavanta Iti. Now, you can say that Krishna is anticipating that Arjuna might be thinking that okay, not being subject to destruction, then they are eternal. Then we see that one's mother, father and all of them are destroyed. And these are perceived. They are abhajita pratiti. They are, can perceive that they are dying directly. So who are iti abhajita pratitehi ke vishaya? So who's being destroyed? Who's being destroyed? He answers antavanta iti nityasya sharirinah ime karma phala bhogayatana bhutah pancha mahabhuta avayava upachitah dehah antavantah vinashinah uktah vyasadi bhihi. See, Krishna said that these material bodies of the eternal embodied soul are said to be perishable. Antavantaha, perishable, ime, all these, deha, material bodies, nityasya, eternal and existent, uktah are said, sharirinaha, of the embodied soul. So they are said to be, they are said to be eternal. He also points out that the bodies are aggregates of the five gross elements, earth, water, fire, air, ether, and they are means for the experience of one's karma. So because they are aggregates, they are naturally subject to destruction. This has been stated, uktaha, this has been stated. By whom? Vyasadibhihi, by Vyasa and others. And then he quotes, tathahi, mata pitra sahasrani putra dara shatani cha samsareshu anubhutani yata yasyanti yanti cha harshasthana sahasrani shokasthana shatani cha divase divase mudham avishanti na panditam dharmo nitya sukadukhe tvanitye jivo nityo heturasyapyanitya iti hetu sthula sukshma shariram sharirino nityatve hetur garbhita visheshanam ahayana Anashina iti. There are many statements like this. And he is giving one sample statement by Vyasadev. Because Krishna is saying it has been stated to be perishable. The bodies are stated to be perishable. So here is a statement. Thousands of mothers and fathers. Hundreds of sons and wives. In this material existence. Who have been... experienced, who have been perceived, they have gone, they will go, and they all are going away. There are thousands of people who are objects of delight, and there are hundreds of people who are objects of lamentation. Every day they overwhelm a fool, but they don't overwhelm a learned person. Dharma is eternal. Happiness and distress are temporary, non-eternal. The jiva is eternal. And the cause behind all this is non-eternal. Then the living entity is said to be inconceivable, immeasurable, aprameyasya. What does this mean? Or why is this used? Anashino prameyasya. The living entity is immeasurable. Why is it said to be immeasurable? Bhagavat kripam shastra mantarena pratyakshadi pramanaihi idamittham iti pramatum ashakyatva. Because it is impossible to prove or it is impossible to measure the living entity is like this merely by sense perception and other sources of knowledge without the mercy of the Supreme Lord and Shastra. Enam vidur vai bhagavat prasadat ityadi acharya padok tescha. Nimbarka Acharya has stated that liberated souls understand the nature of the soul by the mercy of the Supreme Lord. So the factual nature of the soul cannot be understood just like that. Okay, we'll read today's section. Text 21. Veda vinashinam nityam yaenam majamavyayam katham satpurushah parthakam ghatayati hantikam. O Partha, how can a person who knows that the soul is indestructible, eternal, unborn and immutable kill anyone or cause anyone to kill? Everything has its proper utility, and a man who is situated in complete knowledge knows how and where to apply a thing for its proper utility. Similarly, violence also has its utility, and how to apply violence rests with the person in knowledge. Although the justice of the peace awards capital punishment to a person condemned for murder, the justice of the peace cannot be blamed because he orders violence to another person according to the courts of justice. In Manu Samhita, the law book for mankind, it is supported that a murderer should be condemned to death so that in his next life he will not have to suffer for the great sin he has committed. Therefore, the king's punishment of hanging a murderer is actually beneficial. Similarly, when Krishna orders fighting, it must be concluded that violence is for supreme justice, and thus Arjuna should follow the instruction, knowing well that such violence committed in the act of fighting for Krishna is not violence at all, because at any rate the man, or rather the soul, cannot be killed. So for the administration of justice, so-called violence is permitted. So the point is, we should understand that violence has its utility. That's a time for violence. The justice of the peace refers to a judge. This is an old English expression, justice of the peace, judge. So a judge, he sometimes awards capital punishment to a person condemned for murder. But that's according to the codes of justice. And in Manu Samhita, which is Manu's own law book for mankind, he says that if you don't punish this person, he's going to suffer even more in hell. So he reduces punishment by giving him a small bit of punishment. So we should understand that everything in Vedic culture that appears terrible, it is actually a means of reducing the amount of distress that you feel. Many times our devotees, they wonder, why is Varnashrama Dharma, Vedic culture, so terrible? The rules seem so stringent and so terrible. Sometimes they ask, you people are not humane? Why is Vedic culture so apparently grotesque, brutish, inhuman? Like for instance, there was one lady, this comes in Harishori Prabhu's Transcendental Diary, his diary. Young lady, her husband had taken sannyas, devotee, her husband had taken sannyas. She was only some 20 or 21 years old. And she got attracted to some brahmachari. So she wrote to Prabhupada saying that, Prabhupada, my mind is disturbed. I need to have a husband. And this man has agreed to marry me. So Prabhupada got the letter. Immediately he shouted, illicit sex! She was 20 years old. And then he asked one of his senior lady disciples to take care of that lady. And he had her moved from the temple away to another place. And Prabhupada explained, she is a sannyas widow. When a man takes sannyas, it is like dying. So the woman is considered a widow in Vedic culture. And widows don't remarry. In Vedic culture. Keep that in mind. So it seems.
What about widows?
Widows can marry.
Widow cannot marry again. Widow.
Child, anyway. This is how Prabhupada explained it. Widows cannot marry. Standard rules. We are talking of standard rules. There are exceptions. There are exceptions given in scriptures also. But they are exceptions. They are not general rules. Exceptions are exceptions. You cannot make exceptions into rules. In standard Vedic culture, I am not saying that all these things should be applied now in our own way. We should accept Prabhupada as the person who is capable, is a liberated soul. He is capable of making judgments. Which dharma applies where? Because only liberated souls understand which dharma applies where. Non-liberated souls, if they dabble with this, there's a great risk. Dharmasya tattvam nihitam guhaya mahajano yena gatasya pantha. Mahabharata says very clearly, the truth of how to apply Vedic religious principles lies in the heart of the liberated soul. Therefore, we should simply follow in the footsteps of the liberated souls. So, in traditional Vaishnava sampradayas, people don't think independently of their acharyas. They'll always, for everything, they'll see how did the liberated acharya in our line, how did he do? They'll never try to understand, even when they study Bhagavad Gita. For instance, you go to a typical traditional Ramanuja follower. If you ask him to explain Bhagavad Gita, he'll simply open Ramanuja's explanation of Gita and explain that. If you tell him, no, I forget the commentary, you explain the shloka. He said, if I forget him, I forget the Gita also. I only know Bhagavad Gita through Ramanuja. I'm not interested in looking at Gita directly. I look at the Gita directly through Ramanuja. So in Vedic culture, we follow acharyas.
Yeah.
So the point that I'm making is, it seems very grotesque. It seems very brutish, Vedic culture. What kind of terrible, inhuman rule this is? Some young woman, widow, and you're telling that she should not marry just because somehow, you know, her husband died. So it seems so cruel.
But hard.
Harsh, cruel, terrible, inhuman, brutes. But it is not. It is not. Because from the Vedic perspective, Vedic Dharma can be understood only when you understand, like Vanadeva Vidya Bhushan Rupu stated earlier, you should know certain things. Otherwise you cannot understand Vedic culture. You should know that you are a jiva different from the body. You should know principles of karma vipaka, how you have karmic reactions. In other words, you should know reincarnation, you should know the law of karma, you should know how the law of karma acts in the world through many lifetimes. So every activity is seen from the larger perspective of multiple lifetimes. You don't see just one lifetime. This one lifetime paranoia is a typical product of the Western mind. The Western mind, they are indoctrinated in one lifetime. So even when they take shelter of Vedic culture, they want to find happiness within that one lifetime. Within that one lifetime. But Prabhupada explained, no, in Vedic culture, the idea is this life is a preparation for next life. This life is not a preparation within this life. It is a preparation for next life. So in this life, if I tolerate my nasty husband or my nasty wife, or whatever, I just follow religious principles, no matter how terrible my circumstances, then in my next life I'll be able to be peaceful, happy, I'll get a good husband, whatever, all that will happen. So it is a different way of thinking. You cannot come inside one lifetime and examine that. You have to zoom out and look at it from the perspective of multiple lifetimes. Then it makes sense. So similarly, the king's punishing a murderer is capital punishment. He's actually condemned to death, you know. He's condemned to death. Similarly, people who steal, their hands are cut off. So when we say these things and people say, Taliban! This is all Taliban. Terrible. Full of oppressive, brutish, tyrannical rulers. This is India. See what a mess. But India and Kali Yuga is a mess, of course. Who's denying that? Because they're not following the Veda properly. The Veda is not a mess. The Veda is not Taliban. The Veda is not oppressive. But these injunctions are there and they are actually beneficial. This is the point that Prabhupada is driving. We should understand. When scripture says something which appears to be terrible, it is not actually terrible. It is actually good. Like Prabhupada gave the example that when Krishna is telling Arjuna to kill his relatives, that is actually good. It's not bad. Normally it is considered terrible, but under specific circumstances it may be very good. Good means not only good for oneself, it is good for all. It is good for all. Here Prabhupada gives the example of surgery. A surgical operation is not meant to kill the patient but to cure him. A surgeon also brings a knife. He also cuts. Blood will come out. But this is good. Similarly, when we follow dharma, and there is a violence in that, unavoidable violence that is part and parcel of an unavoidable religious duty, then we should not get freaked out. We should not get disturbed. For our own benefit and for others' benefit. And we should listen to the liberated acharya who explains how it should be applied. Yes, you had a question.
Yeah, like some philosophers argue, not only ISKCON or Hindu religion, for all Christians, that most of the scriptures were written by males. And so they give rise to patriarchal male chauvinist society, where males have more power and females don't, and they oppress the women. Right? For example, the widows can't marry, but the widowers can. So it's a decision not equal or for both parties, both sexes. More favorable for men and less favorable for women. So how do we answer such arguments?
The Vedas speak reality. The reality is a man and a woman are not equal. Some of the most powerful anti-feminist writers that I have seen are women belonging to various orthodox religions. There is one young lady in her 20s and 30s, very intelligent lady, Jewish lady, Mrs. Anna. I used to check her blog. She would write powerful arguments. She's an anti-feminist. She writes very powerfully. She says, women become pregnant, men don't become pregnant. So who needs shelter? The one who is pregnant needs shelter. If you want shelter, you have to pay for shelter. Shelter does not come free. So you have to submit. You are not submitting to some man. You are submitting to God's instruction. And God will protect you from this man. God is not... She is quoting their own Jewish scriptures. And she is saying that God does not say unconditionally submit to this man. She says, God says that you submit to this man within religious duties, and he gives protection to women. God provides for protection to women from men who could exploit their position. But first of all, you listen to God. Similarly, I have seen some Christian anti-feminists. But one thing you know, they are all religious and they have faith in God. They have faith in God. And they say, this is reality. This is the reality. The reality is, a woman is more emotional. So naturally, they require to be taken care of by men who are religious. If a man submits to God, then I can submit to him. If a man does not submit to God, I cannot submit to him. So there are... the reality, that's reality. Even in Vedic culture, men and women are not equal. They're not equal. First of all, it is not that a soul getting a male body and a soul getting a female body is the same. Even our own devotees get very irritated when they read or hear Prabhupada's explanation of this. But Prabhupada is transparently explaining. Prabhupada, the previous acharyas, they are transparently explaining these things. The Bhagavatam text itself says it. It is completely against the modern egalitarian idea that men and women are somehow inconceivably they're equal. Inconceivably they're equal. Why they should be equal? That doesn't mean that you exploit women. That doesn't mean you exploit women. Because if you exploit women, then you will be punished. And there are statements on that also. But it's a fact that a soul getting a male body, a soul getting a female body is not the same. The Vedas are very clear on that. Scriptures.
There are different souls, male souls.
No. If a soul performs more activities which are of a more pious type, then he is more likely to have a male body. Now when we say this, our own devotees get extremely angry and irritated. You mean to say I perform some sinful activity, that's why I got a woman body? The Shastra is saying it, what are you supposed to do? Prabhupada himself, when he was told this, he said, Te api anti param gati. He said, Te api. Woman also can go back to God. Why this also? Prabhupada himself, when he was asked, Prabhupada was asked all these questions. He is one liberated soul who has dealt with everything. He is practically our Naveena Vyasadeva. He has given dharma, artha, kama, moksha, prema, bhakti, everything he has spoken. There is nothing under the sky that Prabhupada hasn't spoken about. He has spoken all levels of dharma. He has spoken everything. It's not that Prabhupada only spoke some transcendence and didn't speak material things. He spoke everything. And these questions were asked to him also. And he himself said, they be antiparamati. They also, why is also? Why also? Why Krishna is saying they also can go back to me? They can come to me. Why? So we should accept reality, that's it. The point is we should accept reality. If men are abusing women, then that is a separate problem. Just like the normal procedure is, children should listen to parents. If parents abuse the children, that's a separate problem. But normalcy is, you have a responsible parent, you have a submissive child, and a child should listen to the parent. They're not equals. They're not equals. So, But these are all fundamentally opposed to some of the foundational beliefs of the Western civilization. Like they believe that men and women are equal. No matter how much scientific evidence or any type of evidence you try to produce, the very research that you do is supposed to be flawed because you believe that men and women cannot be equal. So there's something, you're a psychopath. You're one of those aggressive, oppressive, male chauvinistic pig. So you cannot even count it as a theory. You cannot even consider this you cannot even postulate the possibility that men and women, men could be superior to women, and we could do a research which demonstrates that. No, you're a male chauvinistic idiot for even conceiving of, for even imagining that postulate. And you must have abused 20 women, I know for sure. So these kind of emotional responses both men and women evoke. In Vedic civilization, you don't like that. You speak reality. Speak reality.
The former Prime Minister of Australia took advantage of this equal rights movement. Now he said yes, they should have equal rights, and he took a political advantage of that. And in Australia, men were getting the pension from the age 65 and women were getting it from age 60. So he made both the ages equal 65. Equal rights for it.
No, but if see, this whole equal, despite all these equal rights, what has happened ultimately? Families are shattered and broken. Okay. You look at Orthodox religious families, Christians, Jews, even amongst followers of the Vedas. Those who have strong faith in their scriptures. Now the script, if you look at the monotheistic scriptures, religions of the world, they're distinctly anti-feministic. That's one reason why feminists don't like these scriptures.
Yeah.
They have a problem with all the monotheistic religions because they see everywhere the same pattern. You know, God is always considered the father. You always have this patriarchal image. You know, so they're irritated with that. But these emotional responses don't change reality. Women simply need to be properly taken care of. Like when Prabhupada was asked, women are trying to, we are trying to make women and men equal. Then Prabhupada said, we are not trying, only you people are trying. Then he said, the problem is, there are no first class men. That is why the women are disturbed and they are disturbed. And he said, that's a real problem. And he said, therefore I want to create first class men. In my Gurukul, I will train the boys in sense control and detachment, and I will train them to be first class men, and I want to train our girls to be first class women. First class woman means they are submissive to first class men. As a wife. Now, Vedic culture does not, also see, many of the misunderstandings are because of sometimes some foolish, superficial idea, like this idea that all women in Vedic culture are below all men in Vedic culture. This is completely bogus. Because there are varnas. There are various varnas. And corresponding to the varna, like for instance, you have a Brahmana man, a Brahmana woman. A Brahmana woman is higher than a Kshatriya man. You understand? So what to speak of Vaishya man? What to speak of some Shudra man? Similarly, a Kshatriya woman is the queen. She is higher than Vaishya men and a Shudra men. So there are, in other words, you can't just reduce Vedic culture to all men are great, all women are low. It's not like that. You've got to carefully consider. There are various considerations. Consideration of varna, consideration of age, consideration of relationships. For instance, a wife is supposed to listen to her husband. Okay, so it appears that man has more privilege than woman. But a husband is supposed to listen to his mother. You see? So it is not some black and white simplistic thing that all women are low, all men are high. It's not like that. You got to carefully examine. It is something like Sanskrit grammar. Vedic culture, if you want to understand how complex it is, if you study Sanskrit grammar, you'll understand it. There is one rule, then there is a counter rule, there is a counter to that counter rule, then there is an exception, then there is a circumstance which overrides all of these things. then there are optional rules. It could be like this, it could be like that. So Vedic culture is somewhat like that. Vedic Dharma is something like that. So you got to study it. Only when you study it, you understand it. You got to sit down and do the hard work of studying it. So, but all these modern people, both people who, there are many Hindus and Indians who try to defend Vedic culture, but they haven't studied it. So they defend in some foolish way. And those are scholars, even the non-believers, they have studied it. So they will immediately point out all these exceptions. Hey, what is this you are talking? You people don't know what you are talking. Because it's very embarrassing. So it is not, so there are general rules. Generally when we say women are supposed to be subordinate to men, we are talking of wives being subordinate to husbands, daughters being subordinate to fathers. That's what we are generally talking of. When Prabhupada is talking of statements like this, it should be understood in that context. The other thing is, in Vedic culture, every statement has a context. You don't make universal statements. You see, every statement has a context. When you say that no living entity should be hurt, Mahimsyat Sarva Bhutani, that statement has a context. No living entity should be hurt, except in a war, in a religious war, which follows Vedic culture. So that exception is there. So you should understand every statement, every Vedic injunction, every scriptural statement to have a context. Similarly, when it says that, that women should submit to men, this is the rule. Women don't have any independence. Manusamhita, one of those most irritating statements that Prabhupada regularly quotes. Women don't deserve independence. It has a context. It should be understood. What is the context? And you have to, you can understand it by examining Prabhupada's own explanation of it in various contexts. Prabhupada's explanation is reasonable. He's not producing an unreasonable, demoniac, some kind of brutish understanding of male-female relationship. Prabhupada's very sane and rational. But he's speaking reality, which is very irritating to people of the modern world. But anyway, feminism is not going to run for too long. Another 20, 30 years, that's all. Because the reality is reality. You know? There are ladies, I was reading an article in one of the news websites some 6 months back, that there are women in Harvard who are giving up their PhDs to go back home to take care of their children and husbands. Because they are tired of this. They are saying, we don't want this career outside home. All we want is, we want a husband to love us, take care of us, and we want some babies. That's what we want. You people, you have messed us up because you people, you went outside home. We don't want to go outside home. If a woman feels security, then she'll submit. When she doesn't see security, only then they get, they speak all this logic and this and that. When she sees security, she's peaceful. So, and like Prabhupada explained, the problem is there are no first class men. And then when they asked him also, so what is the solution? Prabhupada said, there's no solution. This is another feature of Vedic culture. It doesn't give all pervading solutions to every problem. Even if you want solutions, some solutions are long term. Like Prabhupada said, for this, how do you solve this problem? He said, this can be solved by training the next generation. So only next generation has the possibility of solving this problem. This generation simply suffer till you die, that's all. Tolerated. That's all. Painful reality. This is Vedic culture. You come into Varnashrama Dharma, you have to accept that, bite your teeth and accept it. Which even my grandmother will tell me. She's not even a devotee. Even she, they'll know. In India, they generally know. They tell you that family life is miserable. They tell you all these things. They're not devotees or transcendentalists. They don't have any concept of liberation. They tell you it's all like that, but you have to, these are regulations given by God, so you have to bite your teeth and tolerate your wife, children, your boss, your brothers.
So, thus it's like, you know, like the Prabhupada said about how to define illicit sex, you know, about should be within marriage and
for
children.
Yeah.
But that I see in other Gaudiya Maths, they don't emphasize too much on this.
No, but Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati, Bhakti Vinod, yes, they talk about this. Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati, Bhakti Vinod, they talk about this. In general, by stating that one should not be addicted to one's own wife.
Addicted to one's wife, what means that?
Whatever all it means, all including. They are in fact more strict than us. They are more strict than Prabhupada.
In which sense was?
Prabhu, a Brahmana cannot even kiss his wife. Do you know this?
Oh, really?
That's
in Dharma?
That is in Shastra.
In
India, you go to Brahmin families. A man cannot even touch his wife. In traditional Brahmin families who are maintaining culture even now. 60 years back, everybody knew Brahmins were like this. You don't have romance between husband and wife. Husband and wife don't have a room to sleep in. I have seen a Brahmin house. How it looks like. First of all, it's huge. There are some 120 members in the family. You know. And men sleep in one area, women sleep in another area. It's exactly as how Prabhupada explains. Women live in the inner quarters.
The older men were staying out.
Not outside. It's an area.
Older men stay in one area. And older
women
stay in another area. So
I've seen in my childhood, you know, we are not even Brahmins. By family, women are all sleeping in one area and men are sleeping in another area. Children have the freedom to sleep here, there, everywhere. They're children, you know. Common. We're not even Brahmins. I've not seen my father and mother even touch.
Really?
Of course. You've seen?
Well, for example, my father would not call my mother by name in public.
Because calling a name is intimate.
But my mother, of course, would not do even in private.
Women don't call husband by name. One cannot call a husband by name. Disciple cannot call a guru by name. Woman cannot call a husband by name.
Oh, really?
Yeah. So many rules, so many regulations. Prabhupada said, if I speak so many things, you'll all faint. So he just said, follow four regulative principles, chant Hare Krishna, 16 rounds, participate in preaching and I will take you back to Godhead, I promise this to you. If you don't, of course, we cannot commit offenses. We have to avoid the 10 offenses to the Holy Name. Anything more than that, the more you look in, there are more rules.
Oh my God, why so many rules?
Because, you know, this is a jail, it's a prison. To get out of this place, you need to have rules. There's so many rules. The Prabhupada is very, very kind and mild, actually. Prabhupada is very mild. Prabhupada is not at all harsh. If you think Prabhupada is harsh, you're in a deep illusion. That means you haven't studied Vedic culture at all. Prabhupada is very mild. His instructions are very, very mild. He's like a mother, basically. Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati may be like a father. Like Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, very strict. But Prabhupada is very mild, like Nityananda Prabhu. Very mild. So don't try to improve on Prabhupada. He's gone to the highest limit. He's gone to the limit of mercy. You know, if we try to go further than Prabhupada, then let's say it's suicide. Spiritual suicide. It's a different culture. Why do you think Brahmins were worshipped? Why do you think Brahmins were funded? Why? A man having sex with his wife, he'll be funded? Why will they fund it? You're having sex, you go earn money. Why I should pay for you? Brahmins were like that. Bhudevas, demigods on earth, they were called. Because they are like this. Controlled people.
You know, even ISKCON say that, you know, this rules is not applied to everyone.
For Brahmanas. Gopi Brahmanandu once told me that these rules are injunctions meant for Brahmanas and those who are mumukshus. They are meant for Brahmanas, Gopi Brahmanandu said. But we should keep in mind that those who are seeking liberation, moksha, liberation or higher, they have to accept the Brahmanical standard. So we have to accept the rules and regulations of Brahmana. There are so many rules. Brahmins cannot even have entertainment.
Like
Kshatriyas and all, they can sing and dance and they can do all these entertainment. Kshatriyas, Vaishyas of course, Shudras, no question of that. But Brahmanas, they cannot even do that. The only exception is for Vedic Dharma, there are some like Sankirtan, Harinam Sankirtan. So there Brahmins can dance. Singing is allowed for Brahmana in Harinam Sankirtan, dancing. Otherwise it's forbidden. There's no entertainment for Brahmanas. They're Brahmins. They're not ordinary people.
But they are
Brahmins,
they are still human, right?
This is not human. Brahmin is not a human, he's a demigod on earth. When a Brahmin walks, people offer obeisances to him. Why?
They're demigod.
Because they are following such a high level of standard, high level of culture. Throughout India it was like that. Brahmins have to give in charity. Compulsory rule. Brahmins can optionally take charity. Optional. See?
Optional means?
If he wants, he can accept charity. But he has to give charity. So the system is designed in such a way that if you want to be a bona fide practicing Brahmana, it is like sannyas. That is why in the Varnashram system, Bhaktivinoda also explains, Chaitanya Sikshamrita, only Brahmins can accept sannyas. Kshatriyas, Vaishyas, Shudras, they cannot accept sannyas. Only Brahmanas can accept sannyas. Because they are qualified for it. Because their lifestyle is like that. So even though they were low-class Brahmanas, they were understood to be low-class. And nobody would respect some low-class man. But they were pious. I've seen a Brahmin lady. Even now, very, very pious lady. Very pious lady. She has no passion in her. Old lady. You can say, must be 40, 50 years old. No passion, nothing. It doesn't exist. When you look at these people, you understand. They are piety personified. There are people like that. Prabhupada wanted this movement to produce Brahmanas. See?
I've read Manu Samhita, you know. The rules and regulations are so much, you know. And I don't think none of these people can follow all of them.
Gradually, over the generations, we have to simply follow Prabhupada. And Prabhupada has emphasized certain rules from Manu Samhita. So we should first of all give priority to those rules and interpret them the way Prabhupada has interpreted. And apply them the way Prabhupada wanted it applied. Prabhupada has spoken in great detail about so many things. That's a context to everything. If you don't establish the context, if you simply want to invoke Vedic culture, it will collapse. Gigantic collapse. That's what will happen. It will be such a farce. Vedic culture is supposed to produce people of good character, people who are truthful, who are honest, who are hardworking, who sacrifice for the community, who take care of their children, take care of their wives, submissive to their elders, accept Vedic authority even if they cannot understand it. These are features. So these things, these are primary qualities. How you dress, whether you know Sanskrit, these are all secondary features. Primary features are qualities. Okay, let's proceed. Anyway, my point is, you know, we should not superficially judge elements within Vedic civilization. A surgical operation is not meant to kill the patient but to cure him. Therefore, the fighting to be executed by Arjuna at the instruction of Krishna is with full knowledge, so there is no possibility of sinful reaction. 22. Vasamsi jirnani yatha vihaya navani grihnati naroparani tatha sharirani vihaya jirnani anyani samyati navani dehi. As a person puts on new garments, giving up old ones, the soul similarly accepts new material bodies, giving up the old and useless ones. Change of body by the atomic individual soul is an accepted fact. Even the modern scientists who do not believe in the existence of the soul, but at the same time cannot explain the source of energy from the heart, have to accept continuous changes of body which appear from childhood to boyhood and from boyhood to youth and again from youth to old age. From old age, the change is transferred to another body. This has already been explained in a previous verse, 2.13. So that point about change of body is clarified again in this shloka by giving the example of a garment. So Krishna's point is, you give up old garments and you put on new garments, you give up old bodies and you accept new bodies. Transference of the atomic individual soul to another body is made possible by the grace of the super soul. The super soul fulfills the desire of the atomic soul as one friend fulfills the desire of another. See, even though Krishna is saying the soul accepts new material bodies, it is not that the soul is constitutionally capable of doing all these things. It's the super soul who is basically taking off the old clothes and putting on the new clothes. Like a child. The mother takes off the child's old clothes and puts on new clothes. It's like that. That is done by the super soul. It's possible by the grace of the super soul. The super soul fulfills the desire of the atomic soul as one friend fulfills the desire of another. The Vedas, like the Mundaka Upanishad as well as the Shvetashvata Upanishad, compare the soul and the super soul to two friendly birds sitting on the same tree. One of the birds, the individual atomic soul, is eating the fruit of the tree. And the other bird, Krishna, is simply watching his friend. Of these two birds, although they are the same in quality, one is captivated by the fruits of the material tree while the other is simply witnessing the activities of his friend. Krishna is the witnessing bird and Arjuna is the eating bird. Although they are friends, one is still the master and the other is the servant. Forgetfulness of this relationship by the atomic soul is the cause of one's changing his position from one tree to another or from one body to another. So because we forget this relationship between ourselves and the Supreme Lord, therefore we are made to change our position from one tree to another. The jiva soul is struggling very hard on the tree of the material body. But as soon as he agrees to accept the other bird as a supreme spiritual master, as Arjuna agreed to do by voluntary surrender unto Krishna for instruction, the subordinate bird immediately becomes free from all lamentations. Both the Mundaka Upanishad and Shvetashvatara Upanishad confirm this. Svane vrikshe purusho nimagno nishayasho chatimukhyamana jushtam yada pasyat tanyamisham masya mahimanam iti vitishokah. Although the two birds are in the same tree, the eating bird is fully engrossed with anxiety and moroseness as the enjoyer of the fruits of the tree. But if in some way or other he turns his face to his friend, the Lord, and knows his glories, at once the suffering bird becomes free from all anxieties. So this example of two birds in one tree gives very clear evidence that the individual living entity and the super soul are different. They are different. Even in my childhood, I had come across the Vedic literature and the Upanishads, and I figured out that the mystery of life will be solved if I study the Upanishads and these higher, the spiritual portion of Vedic literature. So I was very intrigued with this. And I had read the standard Shankarite interpretation that's actually the one Brahman. And I had come across this version that the individual soul is simply a reflection. It's just a temporary reflection, not a permanent reflection. And the example of the sun, they had used that example to come up with this idea. But when I came across this two birds in one tree, then I started thinking, now how can you say that the Jivatma is just the reflection of Paramatma? The Paramatma bird is not eating the fruit. The Jivatma bird is eating the fruit. Now there are actually two types of fruits in that tree. One is sweet and the other is bitter. The sweet fruit refers to pious activities. The bitter fruit refers to impious activities. The tree refers to the body itself. So now the Paramatma bird is not eating, it's simply witnessing. And the Jivatma bird is eating. So even at that time, I began to have doubts about Advaitavada. How can you interpret that Jivatma is a reflection? Because in a reflection, whatever the prototype does, the reflection also does. So if the Jivatma bird is a reflection of the Paramatma bird, then the Jivatma bird should also be witnessing. How can the Paramatma bird be witnessing and the Jivatma bird does something else, and you say that Jivatma is a reflection of Paramatma? So I had doubts on that. Of course, Advaitavadis may counteract by saying Paramatma is also illusion. Jivatma is an illusion, Paramatma is another illusion. Both are illusion. Within this illusion, everything is like this, plurality. But the reality is there is an impersonal Brahma. And then if you ask them, but how do you explain this, the sun and the reflections? They keep switching from here to there. So this is an important point. Dvasuparna Yuja Sakhaya. Another statement, other statements also about two birds and one tree. Arjuna represents the Jivatma soul. Krishna is the, he represents the Paramatma. Arjuna represents the Jivatma bird. Krishna represents the Paramatma bird. Arjuna has now turned his face towards his eternal friend Krishna and is understanding the Bhagavad Gita from him. And thus, hearing from Krishna, he can understand the supreme glories of the Lord and be free from lamentation. Arjuna is advised herewith by the Lord not to lament for the bodily change of his old grandfather and his teacher. He should rather be happy to kill their bodies in the righteous fight so that they may be cleansed at once of all reactions from various bodily activities. One who lays down his life on the sacrificial altar or on the proper battlefield is at once cleansed of bodily reactions and promoted to a higher status of life. So there was no cause for Arjuna's lamentation. So the idea is, just as when you change from old clothes to new clothes, you are happy. Similarly, when religious persons like Bhishma, Drona, when they give up, when they change their old bodies, because they are religious, they are going to accept new bodies, young bodies, divine bodies. So they are going to be promoted to a higher status of life. So Arjuna should not lament. 23. Nainam chindanti shastrani, nainam dahati pavaka, na chainam kledayantyapo, na shoshayati maruta. The soul can never be cut to pieces by any weapon, nor burned by fire, nor moistened by water, nor withered by the wind. All kinds of weapons, swords, flame weapons, rain weapons, tornado weapons, etc., are unable to kill the spirit soul. It appears that there were many kinds of weapons made of earth, water, air, ether, etc., in addition to the modern weapons of fire. Even the nuclear weapons of the modern age are classified as fire weapons. But formerly, there were other weapons made of all different types of material elements. Fire weapons were counteracted by water weapons, which are now unknown to modern science. Nor do modern scientists have knowledge of tornado weapons. Nonetheless, the soul can never be cut into pieces, nor annihilated by any number of weapons, regardless of scientific devices. So Prabhupada is giving information of advanced technology in ancient India. There is a fine book by Devamrita Maharaj, Searching for Vedic India. There he talks about higher technology, in ancient India and in other parts of the world. Advanced technology. Talks about that. So the point is, the soul cannot be cut into pieces, cannot be affected by any number of weapons. It cannot be annihilated by any number of weapons. Nothing can be done to it, because it is constitutionally different from matter. It's like, suppose I am sitting on I am using a computer and I am connected to the internet and I am chatting with someone and that person doesn't like me. He feels like punching me, but he cannot punch me. He can maximum send one image of on the screen, but that's all. He cannot do it. Similarly, the soul, even though it is interfacing with the external material world through the body, it is actually constitutionally different. So nothing can be done to it, because it is actually separate. Asango yayam purusha. Soul is constitutionally separate, different. Prabhupada also uses following Baladeva Vidyabhushan, he begins to explain that this has a higher implication. The Mayavadi cannot explain how the individual soul came into existence simply by ignorance and consequently became covered by the illusory energy. So the Mayavadi cannot explain this. How did this happen? How the individual soul came into existence? If you say, like Prabhupada many times would say, that the impersonal Brahman is covered by ignorance, and that part of the impersonal Brahman which is covered by ignorance is the Jiva. But Prabhupada also explained that how can the absolute truth be covered by ignorance in part or in whole? So the Mayavadi is usually stuck, the Advaitavadins are stuck with that. Nor was it ever possible to cut the individual souls from the original Supreme Soul. Rather, the individual souls are eternally separated parts of the Supreme Soul. Because they are atomic individual souls, eternally, sanatana, they are prone to be covered by the illusory energy, and thus they become separated from the association of the Supreme Lord. Just as the sparks of a fire, although one in quality with the fire, are prone to be extinguished when out of the fire. Spulinga Riddhagne Rivachidanavo Jivanachaya. The living entities, they are like sparks that come out of fire. Hare Surya Seva Pratagapi Tutad Bheda Vishaya. Vashe Maya Yasya Prakriti Patire Veshvaraiha Sajivo Mukto Pi Prakriti Vashayogya Swal Kunataha. This comes in Jaiva Dharma. Bhaktivinoda. This is one of his Dashamul Shlokas, where he is defining the nature of the soul based on the Upanishads and scriptures. He's defining, he's summarized the scriptural descriptions of a soul, collected it all into one shloka. And he explains that the living entities, they are like sparks that emanate from, if you consider Lord Hari to be fire, then the living entities are like the sparks that come out of it. Spulinga Riddhagne, of a blazing fire. Spulinga Riddhagne riva. They are chiddanavaha, they are chiddanus, they are spiritual atoms. It's like photons or light atoms coming from the sun. Vashe maya yasya prakriti patireveshvaraiha. And the distinction between the Lord and the Jiva, when we talk of Jiva, we are talking of Jiva Matra. We are talking of Jiva alone. Whether the Jiva is in the spiritual world, material world, that's not the point. We're talking about the Jiva alone. The distinction between the Lord and the Jivas is, the Jivas, the Lord is constitutionally having Maya under his control. Maya is always under him, under all circumstances. Vashe Maya Yasya Prakriti Patir is the Lord of Prakriti. Deveshvaraiha. Sajivo Mukto Api Prakriti Vasha Yogya Swagunataha. Whereas the Jiva, by his own nature, he can come under the influence of Prakriti. It is the Jiva's very nature that he can come under the influence of Prakriti. The Lord, by his very nature, cannot come under the influence of Prakriti. This is the distinction between the Lord and the living entities. Bhaktivinoda establishes this. Ubhaya Vaibhava Yogya, he says in Annaya Sutra. They are capable of being in the material world or in the spiritual world. They are eternally, constitutionally capable of that. That capability exists in them. So that is the nature of the living entities. The living entities, they can constitutionally, they are capable of coming under the influence of Maya. So they can, we can easily explain how the individual soul came under Maya, how it got covered by Maya. Because we are clearly defined it like that. Because just as a spark, although one in quality with fire, a spark is prone to be extinguished when out of the fire. The fire is not. So we don't have the problem that the Mayavadis have. The Advaitavadins have a problem. They can't explain how the how you become covered by the illusory energy. But we can explain that. In the Varaha Purana, the living entities are described as separated parts and parcels of the Lord. Vibhinnamsha. This is the technical expression. Vibhinnamsha. Vibhinna amsha. Vibhinna means separated. Whereas the Lord's plenary portions, they are swamshas. You can call them abhinnamshas. They are not separated from Him. They are non-different from Him. In the Varaha Purana, the living entities are described as separated parts and parcels of the Supreme. They are eternally so, according to the Bhagavad Gita also. So, even after being liberated from illusion, the living entity retains a separate identity, as is evident from the teachings of the Lord to Arjuna. Arjuna became liberated by the knowledge received from Krishna, but he never became one with Krishna. Notice this. Arjuna became liberated. Nashto moha smritir labdha. Later on he will say, Krishna, my illusion is destroyed. I have regained my memory. And then what? Then he says, come, let's merge. He doesn't say that. Just karishye vachanam tava. I will do whatever you say. So the status of liberation is, you agree to do whatever Krishna said. Arjuna became liberated by the knowledge received from Krishna, but he never became one with Krishna. There's one more shloka. I'll read it anyway. 24. Achedyo yam adahyo yam akledyo shoshya eva cha nitya sarvagata sthana rachaloyam sanatana. This individual soul is unbreakable and insoluble and can be neither burnt nor dried. He is everlasting, present everywhere, unchangeable, immovable and eternally the same. All these qualifications of the atomic soul definitely prove that the individual soul is eternally the atomic particle of the spirit whole, and he remains the same atom eternally without change. The theory of monism is very difficult to apply in this case, because the individual soul is never expected to become one homogeneously. So notice that the living entity is described as unchangeable. So Prabhupada is saying the theory of monism is very difficult to apply in this case, because the individual soul is never expected to become one homogeneously. The jiva can never become Brahman. Of course, the Advaita Vadin may say, but the jiva is already Brahman. It doesn't become Brahman, it is already Brahman. But if it is already Brahman, then how did it get covered by Maya? So then they get stuck with that point. After liberation from material contamination, the atomic soul may prefer to remain as a spiritual spark in the effulgent rays of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. But the intelligent souls enter into the spiritual planets to associate with the Personality of Godhead. So those souls who accept the nature of their own Swarup as being eternal servants of the Lord, they want to be in the spiritual planet, associate with the Lord and serve the Lord. And therefore they are considered to be intelligent. Whereas those who don't want to do that, they are not considered so intelligent. Yenye ravindakshya vimukta manina vayyasta bhavada vishuddha buddhaya. Their intelligence is impure. That is why they may be thinking themselves liberated. The impersonalists. Yenye ravindakshya vimukta manina vayastabhavada vishuddha buddhaya aruhya krishrena param padam tatah patantya dhona adhrita yushmanam. There are many impersonalists who, with great difficulty, this is a statement from the 10th canto of the Bhagavad. There are impersonalists who have done great sadhana and with great difficulty they climb up to the spiritual status, to Brahman realization, but they are averse to service to the Lord's lotus feet. And they are described as having impure intelligence. They fall down, back into material life. The word sarvagata, all pervading, is significant because there is no doubt that living entities are all over God's creation. See, notice the word sarvagata. The living entity is described as sarvagata. Sarvagataha, which means all pervading. The living entity is present everywhere. He is everlasting, present everywhere. Now the Mayavadis, they like, Advaitavadis like statements like this. He's present everywhere. See, he is Brahman. He's present everywhere. He's in reality, he's present everywhere. They interpret like that. They think like that. But Prabhupada explains the correct meaning of this. The word Sarvagata, all-pervading, is significant because there is no doubt that living entities are all over God's creation. This is the real meaning of all-pervading. All-pervading means it goes everywhere. Or it means that the living entities as a category are present everywhere. Everywhere there are living entities. They live on the land, in the water, in the air, within the earth, and even within fire. The belief that they are sterilized in fire is not acceptable because it is clearly stated here that the soul cannot be burned by fire. Again, some of the statements of the Western scientists, contemporary Western scientists, latest evidence since a few years back, 5-6 years back or so, that evidence is presented in Searching for Vedic India. You'll find it. Where they have discovered in superheated temperatures there are living organisms below the earth.
Below the earth.
Very hot. So they have discovered that. Super heat. Very, very hot. Very hot. In Searching for Vedic India, Devamrita Maharaj has presented all those scientific statements. But there used to be the belief that they are sterilized in fire. So Prabhupada is writing, the belief that they are sterilized in fire is not acceptable because it is clearly stated here that the soul cannot be burned by fire. Therefore, there is no doubt that there are living entities also in the sun planet with suitable bodies to live there. If the sun globe is uninhabited, then the word Sarvagata, living everywhere, becomes meaningless. So living everywhere includes living even on the sun. And there are living organisms on the sun also. But they don't have to be terrestrial like. There's a different concept of what is life. Life is that which is exhibiting the symptom of consciousness. That which has abhimana, which has a self-identity, which has desire, volition. In Chaitanya Sikshamrita, Bhaktivinoda begins by talking about these points. Okay.
When we talk about living entities everywhere, it is basically spiritual bodies or you mean material bodies?
Have a suitable material body for various material environments.
So not only spiritual body?
No.
It is only in the Vaikunth.
In the spiritual world, in the Vaikuntha Jagat, in the spiritual world. Okay, I'll stop with this. Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama.